Hello and welcome to this edition of the BulletSets.com political podcast with me, Matt Bowler. This time, we sat down with Dan Carlin, podcaster, journalist, and provocateur. Hopefully you already listened to Dan's podcast, Hardcore History and Common Sense. Hardcore History is one of the best history podcasts out there. It really does a great job of contextualizing history and kind of presenting it in this great sort of narrative form. I'll never forget when he compared Abraham Lincoln to Genghis Khan. It was really, really pretty interesting and very witty. Common Sense is his other podcast. That's sort of his editorial podcast where he talks about more contemporary political issues and tries to put them sort of in the longer political lens, the longer historical lens. Definitely some of the best podcasts out there. We talked about media, news, and how that's impacting our political podcasts. What does it mean when you see a story in the news? What's really behind that story? What does that tell you about the journalists that are reporting it? What does it tell you about the people that are reading it? Who's in charge of what? Are readers in charge? Are journalists in charge? Where's responsibility lie? And where is the truth? Where is it? Is it hidden? I don't know. Dan had some really great insights, and I have to admit, we got off to a little bit of a rocky start. My normal partner, Rick Epps, was sick and had completely lost his voice, and that totally threw me off my game. But Dan cut me some slack, and we moved, or better, forged on. And as always, if you want to hop on your political soapbox, you can do that by hopping on ours. Just call 619-663-4531. 619-663-4531. Remember to listen, watch, and share. BulletSets.com political podcast with special guest Dan Carlin. Enjoy. Can't listen to any of our podcasts, but we tend to be very loose form, so I'll probably do a little.
Well, that works for me.
Yeah. So I appreciate you joining. My normal partner in crime, Professor Rick Epps, is down with a flu. We think his son brought it home for him as a little daddy gift. But nonetheless, this podcast I want to talk about news and the media and the history, kind of history of the media and where it has been and where it's from. And we're fortunate to have Dan Carlin with us. And those of you who don't know Dan Carlin's Hardcore History and Common Sense podcasts are definitely two of my favorites, and definitely worth listening to. And thank you for joining us, Dan. I appreciate you calling in.
Well, I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
I thought it would be great to talk to you because you worked in traditional media for a long time, and then you transitioned into online media, and you've been there and a great success. Plus, you're a history nerd, and you have that great kind of perspective to bring to just kind of all parts of your life, sort of this really kind of interesting humanistic point of view that I kind of infer from your Common Sense podcast. You kind of take all aspects of what you know and are able to apply it really well to the rest of your perspective on things. So let me start with give you a little history of me. I've been San Diego media here, local news, for a long time. I'm a local news legacy here. My grandfather ran the evening newspaper. For those of you that don't remember, there used to actually be two newspapers in every city. But those have long since gone away. Most daily publications have long since gone away. A lot of newspapers have gone to 2-3 times a week. I know Detroit got rid of, God, most publications. I think they still keep their Sunday. They're almost a weekly now in Detroit, which is really kind of too bad because the Detroit newspaper was really good. But I remember that. I remember learning to read out of the evening newspaper because it was the great thing that came to your doorstep. You know, Dad came home from work and that's what you sat down and read before you watched TV. Now, nobody does that. Everyone gets it on their phone. They get news as it happens. I've felt that there's been a real good and a bad side to the way things are going with the internet. I feel like things move so fast that no one has time to or desire to interpret it or kind of translate what is actually happening. And whereas it used to be, you know, at least you took a day. People had time to look at it. You had time to vet things. You had time to be to make sure your facts were right. I mean, just basic stuff that a lot of times gets glossed over really quickly, even with major organizations. And I get the impression that that, at least from my perspective, is really influencing how politics is happening and how kind of just the local politics, statewide politics, national politics, and how those things are affecting our daily lives. I feel like the gap between those who know and those who think they know is grown even greater because no one is actually able to take the time to digest what's going on because there's always something new on the horizon just pushing its way in. What do you think about that? I mean, how would you compare this to, say, Jefferson had a press, and he printed sort of a newspaper. It was just propaganda-ish in a way for his perspective, but nonetheless, he printed stuff. Or Franklin had his press, and he printed things. You know, they printed up the Federalist Papers and sent those around, and people had time to kind of digest those things in a way. Whereas today, do you think anything like that could have that same kind of effect, unless it was soundbite quick, under 140 characters?
Is that the question? That
I know. Yeah, that was the question. Do you think that something like, something as thoughtful as what the Federalist Papers were could exist today?
It really depends. I mean, I think in one sense, the Federalist Papers look extra thoughtful to us because it's couched in language we don't use anymore. I mean, it's a little like reading a version of the Bible in the King James style and the flowery vows and all the kind of stuff, and then reading a more modern-day vernacular translation, and you go, oh, it's still smart, but I can understand it now, and certain things make more common sense. That's not to say that those weren't genius documents. They were. But they were also genius documents circulated amongst a very rarefied crowd of people. I mean, it wasn't in general, I don't want to make broad statements here, but it wasn't in general being read by your average blacksmith and your average person out there cutting the wheat down on the farm. And I think that we still have those kinds of things today. Still rarefied. I mean, if you want to talk about the 1% of really informed people or the 1% who pretend to be informed, because I think you brought up an interesting point when you talked about, you know, do we know what we know and what the truth is? Because I was thinking about these, this situation in Venezuela that's going on right now, which is, you know, I have one guy email me and say, there's positively a revolution going on here and you're not talking about it. And then there is darn near a revolution going on in Kiev right now with nine people, I think I saw earlier today, dead. And they want me to talk about that. But I feel like there's a lot we don't know that's going on behind the scenes all the time. Mm-hmm. And I think when you look at things like the Edward Snowden revelations, I think what to me is so valuable about those things is it gives you a tiny little photograph as to what's really going on. I interviewed the TV science historian James Burke once, who's got this fascinating mind, and I asked him a few political questions, and he said, listen, I believe that what is going on behind the scenes has nothing to do with what we think is happening. And he wasn't being all conspiratorial. He was just basically saying that there's stuff that's for public consumption, and then there's the way the real world works. And without knowing how the real world works, that's why those Snowden documents were such a shock to some people and so discomforting to others, you form weird opinions. It's like trying to come up with an algebraic equation, but you're plugging in the wrong numbers. If you don't know what reality is, you're going to come to flawed conclusions. But I don't care if we're all reading the New York Times in 1950 or 500 different blogging sites today. I'm not sure you're getting much in the way of what's really happening anyway. So, I mean, I would contend that I'm not sure the machinations of what goes on between countries and power and behind the scenes, I'm not sure that stuff's ever been in the public realm of conversation.
Do you think there's more of the illusion that that is because I can go to the internet and turn on a live feed from Kiev right now? Do you think people feel like they understand it more?
You can see the events happening, but that doesn't necessarily tell you why they're happening. absolutely, you definitely have a feel for what it's like to be there. And you definitely don't have to have some journalist from 100 years ago describe it to you in words. You can see the pictures. And yes, that's much more helpful. But it doesn't necessarily tell you, you know, what the reason those people are out there in the first place is. You can go and do man on the street or person on the street interviews and ask them. But that doesn't tell you whether the Soviet, or it's not Soviet anymore, the Russian Secret Service or the U.S. Secret Service or 12 different secret services in Syria on all sides are the reason those people have money and printing presses or what have you. So, I mean, knowing a little bit about what's going on behind the scenes, I think, really tells you what's happening. And I'm not sure most of our media outlets tell us that. I think that's why the Snowden thing, when it hits all these different media outlets, you're going, okay, there is a real example of what's really going on. And we don't have to argue right-wing or left-wing or whatever over what the facts are. That's a document. That's a, as far as our intelligence services and government was concerned, that's a fact. And so then you can actually take the conversation one step farther, get away from the stage where you're arguing over each other's facts, and talk about the validity of whether or not you should be doing what that fact says you are doing.
So who's responsible for that? Is it the journalist that isn't getting this story, or is it the viewer or reader that isn't looking for this story and demanding it in a way?
Well, I'm not sure it's ever been particularly the kind of thing that most media outlets love to pursue. I mean, we always think of the Washington Post as being this enterprising newspaper where Woodward and Bernstein helped bring down a president and all that, all the wonderful myth-making stuff. And I would argue that I do think that's sort of the high watermark of American journalism. But, you know, right after that story broke and the Washington Post got all these accolades and kudos for doing it, their editor spoke at a conference where she basically told the movers and shakers in D.C., don't worry, we're not going to make a habit of doing this thing. You don't have to worry that all your secrets are going to be splashed on the front pages. You know, that's not what we're about. In other words, the enterprising journalist, at least through most of journalistic history, didn't have the opportunity to do these stories anyway, because the publisher controlled whether or not the stories made it into print or what have you. I think we could have an argument now that maybe with the democratization, maybe the temporary democratization of the ability to get information out into the public sphere, that maybe some enterprising journalist who's after nothing but a good story could uncover something like this. I mean, I think you could make the case that some already have.
But that kind of goes to the next point about shield laws and how kind of these traditional journalistic protections have been there. And there's a real fight against having those protections there for bloggers and independent journalists.
And I think that's, to me, that shows the ridiculousness of the whole thing. I mean, this idea, I mean, I've been a journalist, you're a journalist. This idea that we're some scientist or doctor who has some really super special ability that deserves extra protection from the better bloggers and everything. Personally, I don't even think it's journalists who care that much about something like that. They'd like a shield law for themselves, but I don't think they care so much whether bloggers get it or not. I think it's the government and the outlets that are going to be exposed that want to have people that they can put pressure on their employers, which is how it used to be. Mm-hmm. You know, you put pressure on the boss. So I got in trouble once for exposing something where a government agency got in trouble, and I got in trouble because then they put pressure on my boss. That's a wonderful way to instill choke points into the informational conduit from the journalist to the public. If we're all journalists, and if your stuff is protected just like CBS News' stuff is protected, well, then that choke point goes away. I don't see how that's bad for us. It might be bad for the people that want a choke point there, I guess is what I'm saying.
I heard you talking about Feinstein.
Yeah.
If I understand it correctly.
Not my favorite politician.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Feinstein, it's almost like she read a blog that she didn't like, so she decided she was going to go out. I don't know the whole backstory on that, on her decision to take that perspective. It always kind of makes
me curious. Here's what I always want to say to them. Does she think when the Constitution was written and freedom of the press was granted, enunciated, whatever you want to say, does she think there were accredited news organizations? There was no AP. Yeah, there was no UPI. There was no Reuters. It was a guy with a printing press in his barn. That's who got it. Basically, I mean, the way to look at it for people who are wondering, it's basically just your normal freedom of speech protection enunciated to say it's not just your right to yell it in the public square. You can put it on a piece of paper and hang it up somewhere and walk away. It's the same right. It's just a different method of distribution and how long it lasts. For Dianne Feinstein and the people who want to say that there should be special rules for, you know, quote, end quote, accredited journalists, and none of the other people deserve that protection, you would have to believe that's how the founders wanted any of that, that's how they saw it. This is not a protected class. I think I worked in news in Los Angeles, where half the reporters we had there were there because they had a fantastic hairstyle, a great gleam in their eye. I mean, whatever. This is not a protected class of scientists we're talking about here, who deserve a level of protection above what some of these serious and quite talented bloggers are putting out.
So is it, are these bloggers getting enough attention sort of in the mainstream viewership? Is it mainstream people? Rick and I always have this argument, and partly because I think, you know, he's a professor. And he says, look, sometimes you have to tell people what they need to hear, not what they want to hear. And the big problem is in mainstream news, particularly on TV, you're telling people what they want to hear so you can keep those eyeballs, carry it through that half hour, that hour, so that you don't end up with a drop-off after you come in off of American Idol. You want to keep those numbers high and maintain that follow-through so you can sell ads all the way through. Now, but you still have to somehow inform people. And Rick's argument
I think you got two separate things going on here, because I like both of those subjects, but I think there's two of them. One has to do with the dumbing down and the infotainmentizing, for lack of a better word, of news. The other has to do with the self-selection of the viewer choosing the kind of news they want. Two separate problems, both very interesting. Start with the second one first. I agree with your partner in the sense that it's a little like the difference between learning on your own or going to college and being taught. A lot of the history show stuff I do. I was a history major. I have a degree in history from college, but I don't have a doctorate, right? And people will say to me all the time, well, you know, you can learn it all from books, Dan, and that's how I learn. But that doesn't teach you a lot of the nuances. It doesn't tell you what to look for. I always thought that college was great because they would teach you things you didn't know you wanted or needed to learn. And if you'd been left to your own devices, you wouldn't have learned them, right? But once you do, you see, oh, it's totally connected and important. The way news needs to operate to a certain degree is there's stuff the public doesn't know they need. They'll be very glad they have it once you give it to them, but if you put them in total command of the selection process, they're not going to know that they're interested in that necessarily. And so I think what your compatriot is saying is that sometimes people need to know this is happening. It's important for their role that they play as a citizen, where elections are supposed to decide policy. There's a certain base level of information they really have to be informed citizens. And I think that's what he's talking about. But if you get to choose the news story you want and you search for cat stories all day long in the news, I'm not sure you're doing your foundational duty as an informed citizen. Now, the other side, what you talked about, is, and this has been going on obviously for a long time, is the dumbing down and the infotainmentizing of news. And there's a lot of different trends, as you know, that play into that. Everything from costs to viewers to, I mean, my goodness, it's older than most people think. I remember walking around the newsroom at KABC in L.A., and the news writers would always keep they would cut out the ad from the mini documentaries that they had worked on over the years that would win awards and whatever by their desk, and they had one that said, "Catting out with Tawny Little," who was the Miss America that worked at our station, but she was the anchor, and they gave her a mini doc series that was based on stepping out on your husband. And so for five nights, we would do 3 minutes each night on stepping out on your. It was the 70s, and that was perceived to be a topic that would drag in viewers on the local news. And you just turn around and go, "Really? We did that, and then we covered some heavy duty story? I mean, it doesn't even make any sense." But I guess what I'm saying is the idea of showing fluff or even the stuff, you know, if it bleeds, it leads type stories, where there's no news value at all, but the wreck is horrible. And, oh, my God, you know, how many times, those of you who've worked in newsrooms where showing visuals was an important part, would the cameraman come back and just say, you will not believe this footage? And when you see it, you go, well, we got to figure out a way to show that. But it has no value other than, whoa, let's show that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we had something like that happen here yesterday out in the middle of nowhere on a road between San Diego and Tecate, which is just, I don't know if you've ever driven down the road.
In New Mexico and Arizona, yeah. All the stories are like this.
Yeah, it's in the middle of nowhere. There's only ranchers and people who make meth out there. I think the last story we did was some guy who made a homemade cannon out there and killed his girlfriend. A semi full of chickens wrecked.
Yes,
and
classic.
So that was the live story. Look at all these chickens. Yes. There are more than 100 chickens on the loose. And
there's no real news value unless you're driving on that road stuck in traffic.
Unless you're one of the four people that was road at 12 o'clock at night.
So I guess what I'm saying is welcome to television news. I'm not sure it's ever been any different. I think once you decided you could make money, or once the networks figured out they could make money with it, is when it started to go downhill. Because when it was a necessary evil that the rules required them to have 15 minutes of news every night. Mm-hmm. It was dry and boring, and they still sold soap in the middle of it.
Yeah.
They had the Walter Cronkite, Edward R. Murrow anchor would be doing a story about Sputnik, and then all of a sudden he's selling soap in the middle of the newscast. Let's not romanticize it to a super degree, but I would suggest that what we have now is the Wild West of open communications. And I don't know if it's going to last. I think in a lot of these more repressive countries, you're already seeing them try to find a way not just to shut it down when they want to shut it down, but actually use it to find out who the troublemakers are and stuff sometimes.
Well, that kind of goes to...
We're in a shakeout period right now.
Yeah, I mean, that goes to net neutrality as well, too. There was this story the other day about how Netflix is running slower on certain Verizon cable networks than other, and people are VPNing into Netflix in order to increase their bandwidth speed. This was at least the rumor I heard, and it was happening maybe mainly on the East Coast, and I wasn't able to confirm it, but it kind of talks about sort of the net neutrality with the merger of Comcast and Time Warner now, what the future kind of holds for people, particularly for just sort of these bloggers out there that... Drudge started as, he's just an aggregate. He started as just a blogger, you know,
yeah.
And you look at his site and it's just a list of stories. And if people weren't able to access that, I'm sure their perspective on where these stories are coming from naturally would be totally different. Drudge has had such a huge impact just on what gets seen. You know, there's huge competition for Drudge just to get on his aggregate.
Well, what I always tell people with things like the net neutrality thing is that, you know, there's a certain ability we all have to predict where certain things are going to go. And I always think it's a little disingenuous when someone argues against it. But all these companies, the ones that are laying down new cable and putting money into infrastructure and all that stuff, all these companies have shareholders. And they have a fiduciary responsibility to these shareholders to maximize gain. They are leaving so much money on the table if they don't do preferred treatment on their networks.
Mm-hmm.
To not be able to go to the high-priced companies and say, hey, you know what? We're not slowing anybody down, but we can give you extra speed. And to not do that would almost be to violate their fiduciary responsibilities to their shareholders. There's a ton of money that comes from being a gatekeeper on delivery of content. So the idea that they're not, when I hear people say, no, they won't do this, I turn around and say, they have, you could almost sue them if you were a shareholder and they didn't.
Yeah, it kind of seems very unfair, and nobody knows how to fight this because people think their cable company is a utility like electricity or water. Now, or they think their internet provider is like a utility, and it's not.
Well, what I always tell people is, listen, I'm not saying that a law that says you can't do these things is the best way always to fix the problem, because then I'll hear from people who talk about the need to balance traffic and all that. But without a rule like that inhibits the fiduciary responsibility rule, It almost has to happen. With a rule in place, those companies and everyone else can just say, yeah, we'd love to make money off that avenue, but right now we're not allowed to. So, I mean, I'm not saying anybody's evil in this deal, but I think those little fig leaf rules actually keep the floodgates from opening up. And you want to talk about changing the new media landscape, start throttling people's data.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they're already doing that in a lot of places, in a lot of different ways. Data limits on home lines. Definitely, I think, limits access, particularly to larger files, particularly video content. If you don't want to use your cable company, a lot of people were switching over to like a Roku or Apple TV, for example. And then you can just kind of watch what you want to watch. You know, you can go to YouTube, and if you wanted to watch some libertarian right-wing Tea Party style thing, you could easily access that. Or if you wanted to watch Democracy Now, you could easily access that in the same way. But now with these data limits, it's a little harder to get into that as much as people would like to, and abandon your cable altogether. So I remember that was there was definitely a big push for that, at least in San Diego.
Well, when you see these companies buying both the transmission of the content and the content, you know, companies that make and distribute content from the old media, when you combine a Comcast with an NBC, for example, you can begin to see the strategy. I mean, you don't have to be Einstein to see
going. No. I heard this great 5-minute sum up of all of news history from Mitchell Steffens from NYU. He's one of their professors of journalism. And he had this great way of summing up in 5 minutes, and I'm going to do it in less than that. And basically, he said, look, there wasn't really a press as we know it until 18th century with the advent of the steam printing press. Then journalism kind of got started in the way that we understand it today. Before that, it was just person to person. Then it became person to, because you'd had this journalist or whoever it was, person to a million people. And now it's kind of going back to that person-to-person kind of situation, or somewhat a little bit like that, in the sense that one person can have a much bigger impact and doesn't have to be linked to a larger organization.
Well, but let me suggest something, though, that it's not as micro as it sounds, only because, yes, the percentage shrinks. So whereas the Washington Post or the New York Times could be read by 20% of the population, or a network and on TV, you know, 30% of the population tunes in at night. And now, of course, with all the different channels, that's flooded down. But you have an entire globe in terms of how many people are out there. I always joke that I'm a street performer. That basically what I do for a living is do mimes on the corner, and I have a hat out and people throw money in it. But I work a really busy street corner. And that's what this internet thing is. So you may be a blogger that only reaches one out of every 100,000 people, but there's billions of people on the internet.
Yeah.
So it changes the scale of things, even if you're a really, really niche market product.
Now, do you think that's kind of impacting local news and how people understand local news? Because all of a sudden, I can just be obsessed with news, you know, in Kiev. Whereas I don't have to pay attention to what's going on locally for me, whether I'm in L.A. or San Francisco. You know, it seems like a lot of people aren't doing that as much.
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, you know, one person's local story becomes an international story overnight. My wife was working here at a local station here in Western Oregon, and they had a massive school shooting nearby. She goes there, and within an hour, she's live at radio stations all over the country, doing live reports, and you know how that works.
Yeah.
I mean, so all of a sudden, what small local news that you would think, okay, this isn't even really important, something happens and it's a national event, and having local people on the scene to report from there turns out to be very important, even from a non-audience perspective. Think about them as journalists in bureaus in all these local communities waiting for something to happen to tell the people from far away that they'd be interested in it. I mean, these reporters who are in Kiev right now are informing the world on what for them is a local story. But, you know, without them there, it'd be tough to cover. We wouldn't even know what was happening until it was well underway.
But the bureaus are all closing too.
That's been going on for a long time. Yeah.
I mean, it used to be you had a press room at the police station, you had a press room at City Hall, and at the county board of soups, and locally that doesn't even exist for just, you know, I don't think it happened in L.A. You know, when I think of the Bell scandal, from the way I understood it, because I ended up working for Tribune Company down here, and I knew the L.A. Times guy who was one of the last guys that was actually stationed at Bell before he got transferred out when they went through a transition. They ended up abandoning Bell for years. And it wasn't until that years later they got a reporter in there who showed up and was like, what the hell is going on here? You guys are stealing millions of dollars, that they were able to just easily report on it. And it was because they weren't there because of budget cuts, because of whatever, they were refocusing the paper.
Well, let me, it's even worse than that. Let me add another dimension onto it. Not only are they closing bureaus and you have fewer people on staff looking at these kind of stories, but because they don't want to pay, and listen, I understand why, but because they don't want to pay veteran people to do these things, in a lot of places where 15 years ago you might have a reporter with 5 or 6 years experience doing beat checks and all kinds of normal journalistic activities, you have an intern. You know, who's not necessarily, I mean, a lot of the radio stations, I keep, you know, when I was 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we used to have to do emergency broadcast system tests in case something bad happened, like an earthquake or a flood. I'd be shocked if half the radio stations anywhere near where I live could actually do that today with the unpaid interns they have running the equipment there. And again, nothing against them, but when you replace experienced people in journalistic positions with people who are just going through the motions and have never done it before, you lose a certain amount of quality, just like you lose when you close these bureaus.
Whose fault is it? Is it the economy's fault? Is it just sort of the natural growth of things? Is it that we don't value institutional knowledge like this anymore?
A lot of this is by design, and people forget this. But I mean, we passed new telecommunications rules in the 1990s that opened up ownership. You know, there used to be rules, and a lot of people say, "Oh, see, these are the burdensome regulations that keep competition from expanding." But there used to be a rule about how many stations and media outlets one owner could own, and they were rather restrictive. I mean, I think the TV networks were allowed to have 8 owned and operated stations, and all the rest that transmitted their signals around the country were affiliates. Same was for newspapers and radios. You couldn't own all these stations. The minute that law got passed in the middle 1990s, I want to say 1996, 1995, they started buying up, all these media companies started buying up hundreds and hundreds of radio stations. I went from one where we had 8 stations, the owner had 8 stations, he sold it to a company that had 1,000.
Yeah.
Well, when you have 1,000 stations, it's no longer about being the best in every single market. It's about not losing value on the stock market. It changes the whole equation, and it changes the incentives and the disincentives. For all of these companies, it made much more financial sense to let go all their experienced news staffs, hire some intern for minimum wage, and let them read right off the newswire, because they saved a ton of money. So from their perspective, it made total sense. But just like the net neutrality rules we were just talking about, you know, that the rule that said you couldn't own 1,000 stations was like a finger in the dike. Once you take that out, we get massive change and we get it quickly. And that's what happened.
So in San Diego, we've got this great nonprofit news organization, VoicesSanDiego.com, and they focus exclusively on local politics and they do amazing work. And they're funded. They were funded by an endowment, so they're not really responsible for anybody. They get some public funding, and they really do outstanding work. And I think they're a real kind of they're really leading the pack as far as the kind of journalism that could be done online, particularly with local news. Is that kind of the next? Is that the way we go? Is that the direction we kind of have to go into a nonprofit, something that isn't motivated by the stock market, by the value of the company, you know, by these fiduciary responsibilities?
I don't know. I think there's some experimentation in that realm right now. Glenn Greenwald is starting his new outlet with Jeremy Scahill, and they're doing it with a billionaire's money because that matches supposedly the billionaire's point of view on how journalism should be. So in other words, maybe becoming a little like the ancient Republican Romans were, where, you know, massively rich people could sometimes fund these public needs because it made them look good or what have you, sort of purposes for them. So maybe that's the way to go. I'll fall back on what I said earlier, that I think we're in this real shaking out stage right now, and we're seeing people attempt experiments, and then we're going to see how those things go. Some, listen, 15 years ago, the Drudge Report is a massive experiment and total unknown. Now you look back on it and go, oh yeah, sure, there can be something like that. Until we see people try and fail in a bunch of different realms, and there have already been several prototypes come and gone, we're not going to know what sticks and what doesn't. But we're in the phase of definite experimentation.
There was one other guy I wanted to have on, but he got hung up in his story, is Vicente Calderon, and he's no relation to the former Mexican president. But he was an anchor in L.A. for Univision in L.A., and then he left that job and started his own website in Tijuana called Tijuana Press. .com, and they do some really interesting work down there. There are a lot of online news sources in Tijuana, a lot more than you would think. But ironically, the largest buyer of advertiser in Mexico is the government for newspapers and publications. So it's the government. There's all these PSAs and things like that the government buys to put into newspapers. They're the ones that kind of seem to keep a lot of these websites afloat. And should it be the government that has a hand in this, or are we better off keeping the government out of the press? Could we mimic something? I mean, it's always weird to say, could we copy something that's going on in Mexico, because it seems to be working down there. They've got a really vibrant, open, got very aggressive news going on, particularly in Tijuana.
So they have the aggressive news because of the government intervening?
Because the government is the one buying the ads, and so then they can have the websites and the newspaper and the publications to continue, so they can pay salaries and people can make a living at it.
Doesn't it seem like they would have the same control over you, though, that an employer would at that point?
Well, that's the thinking, right? That could happen, but they have a lot of other laws and a lot of public information laws that are a lot more open, ironically, than we do here. Now, it's very dangerous to be a journalist.
Very dangerous, in
Mexico, which is, you know...
Even to be a blogger down there is dangerous.
Yeah. Even to do anything down there is extremely dangerous. However, this is sort of one weird anomaly that's happening in what seems to be keeping these journalists going and making it possible in a way. It would be interesting to see, you know, because the government's
still believe you can make money at this. I still believe that investigative journalism, if done right, is something. And listen, I have to tell you something that I said this on my show at the time. There's a way to use news to make investigative reporting valuable. And just for the audience members who don't know, investigative reporting is both, in my opinion, and a lot of reporters' opinions, the most important stuff that reporters do, where they literally churn up stuff and show it to you. Important things you ought to know, malfeasance, stuff like that, waste of tax dollars, crimes, whatever it might be. But it's also the stuff that's very expensive, and it's not cost-effective. You could send a reporter, and instead of getting three separate stories a day from that reporter, they could spend 3 weeks tracking down this one story. And so most big companies now look at that and go, that's a terrible waste of resources. Yes, but those three stories that reporter gets a day are not going to be of the quality and importance of the thing that would have, you know, taken 3 weeks to do. Glenn Greenwald, when he broke the Edward Snowden story, kept the entire story under wraps and dribbled it out little by little, the same way that the Washington Post dribbled out Watergate stories for months. In other words, taking that investment of time on the reporter's side and making it pay off. Now, in the Watergate situation, they didn't do it on purpose. The news kind of came in trickles. But Greenwald did it on purpose, and The Guardian did it on purpose, because they knew that that would keep it front and center for a long period of time and talked about it and to have more of an impact. There's an art to journalism. There are elements to it that are involve gifted people doing interesting things, like deciding the best way to organize a font in a headline to catch people's eye, or how to use a little color in a newspaper. I mean, these are all little art forms. And if you do it right, I think you can make things like investigative reporting, if you find a real juicy story, have that really pay off for you. I mean, I think The Guardian really raised their global profile during this whole Edward Snowden release, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah. I bet they're...
Been worth a lot of money to them, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I bet the hit count on their website went through the roof, you know.
Okay, so the point is if you do it right, this investigative journalism can do more for you than anything less than the celebrity nude shot that you might have gotten would have done for you. I mean, I think we can all agree that's going to get more hits on your website than anything. But
it's so much easier, I think, a lot of times to get a blonde and stick her in front of a camera and have her read a press release.
Yes. And cheaper, believe it or not.
Yeah, because they're replaceable. There's just, you get another blonde. You know, that's the Fox News formula. You just take a pretty girl.
You can even take it to the reductio level where you look at the Russian newscast where they were doing it naked. Remember?
Yeah.
I mean, serious newscast where they're reading serious hard news, no clothes on. I mean, what are they really saying to you at that point? I mean, you can get your news from any old station, or you can get it from a place where the people are naked. Make your choice.
Yeah.
How much slack do you cut them on this, on the accuracy of their news if they're naked while they're giving it? Yeah, they're not the most accurate news in town, but that anchor's cute.
I wonder what their numbers are like, you know?
I do too, actually. And the demos.
Yeah. Who is watching this?
Who is watching?
Men.
Government officials.
Men, 16 to 28, unmarried.
That's
right.
But the most informed demo in the population, so, you know.
They probably have the sound down.
But, I mean, in a funny way, that's where you should maybe take it. If you want to have a really kooky and yet insightful conversation on modern American journalism, take it down to that level and say, what if we were just naked? Would you listen to the important information then? I mean, what is it going to take to package this important information? You need to be an informed citizen so that I can give you your medicine in a way where it goes down just the way you like it. What do I have to do, you know? Free stuff? Rebates? What do you need?
Yeah. Well, you know, you look, we're coming out of sweeps right now. And, you know, we have got four contests this sweeps, gave away a truck, gave away all kinds of stuff just to get people to click like on our Facebook page and get onto our website. You know, we're every station is would do that, I bet, if they were allowed, you know. I'm curious, what do you think about groups like Vice? I've always kind of been, it's kind of like this, it's kind of like prurient news in a way. I feel like Vice does these interesting sort of kind of information spectacle news. And by that I mean, I looked at that, the North Korea story Vice did for HBO a while ago. This kind of illustrates it. They went and they sent one of their reporters and photographers with Dennis Rodman when he went to North Korea. They didn't really tell us anything new. And when you compare it to the Frontline story in North Korea, clearly Frontline was just head and shoulders a lot better at their investigation. But they went to North Korea. They went on the same tour. I guess you can buy a tour package that they went on. And then, you know, they went with Dennis Rodman and played basketball with him, got a shot of the supreme leader there with Dennis Rodman, and then came back and talked about how weird North Korea was. Now, are they bringing people news, or is this like information spectacle?
A little of both. Yeah. Because I think the Dennis Rodman thing is definitely the spectacle. I think you could make an argument that North Korea being as closed as it is, with as many rumors that they have, that almost any info or pictures or anything that you can get out of there to show the rest of the world is in some sense maybe newsworthy. So maybe a little of both.
Yeah, I definitely was a big fan of the Frontline story. I thought the Frontline story was incredible, the video.
Well, I think when it all comes out one of these days, because I think you are going to have a Berlin Wall kind of moment at some point.
They're just going to rush through. And that's
Yeah, and maybe sooner than we think. But I think when that happens and we find out the depths of, it's almost like a giant human experiment going on mm-hmm. over there about, you know, we always joke about what would happen if all of these modern things we have in our country now fell into the hands of a totalitarian, you know, what could Hitler or Stalin have done with today's technology? Well, the North Koreans don't have our level of technology, but they have enough technology to make that almost a laboratory experiment. I mean, supposedly, don't quote me on this because we don't exactly have reporters over there telling us what's going on. Supposedly, North Koreans wake up in the morning to their TV talking to them, with the government talking to them, and it can hear what you say back. And I mean, it's all this stuff.
You know what this
sounds like? The outer limits, man.
Yakov Smirnov did a podcast with Mark Maron, and he was talking about growing up in, he was in Odessa. And he, I guess his family had
down in the Crimea.
He had, his family had one room, in a commune kind of setup, and then another family had another room, this 8-room house kind of thing. And in each room there was a speaker, and it was either on or off, and that was it. And it essentially worked the same way. You would turn it on to hear whatever was going on, and then they were convinced that everybody could hear them back. That there was someone at some ministry listening to what's going on in the family. It was fascinating to hear him talk about this and then talk about his early career as a comedian on these little tour ships in Russia on the coast there.
Well, I think it's funny, too, because you have both extremes. You get these, like the Khmer Rouge would try to kill all the intellectuals and go back to, you know, a 14th century style economy. And then you have like the North Koreans are like, you know, how can we use this technology to keep tabs on people more? I mean, there's going to be some fascinating sci-fi stories.
Yeah, all they have to do is give everyone an iPhone. And they can keep tabs on everybody at all times.
That's the finesse way to do it. That's why the North Koreans are brutish about how they do it. You gotta make us pay for the means to spy on us. And that's really where it hurts.
Actual military conquest is so passe. Come on.
You can make money getting these people to help us spy on them. And now our new keystroke insurance device.
I know.
Worried you forget what you typed a minute ago? Buy this device. You'll know.
Don't worry. Anywhere. Don't worry. When you're ready to give up the copyright on your thumbprint, just buy the iPhone 5.
You know, it's funny. I keep trying to think of alternative realities. Like, is the direction we're going with all this stuff mandated? I mean, is there no other future for us? I mean, if we decided tomorrow we don't like the direction all this is going and we'd like a little bit more protection for personal autonomy, is that even possible? Could anybody stand in front of the impetus that human society has going in that direction and say, stop and get it to stop? I don't think so, but I think it's an interesting question to ask. I'm not sure we have any choice in the matter at all.
It'd be a little like fighting the sky for being blue.
I think it is an almost gravity kind of an effort to overcome, maybe. But I do think it's going to be, you know, I have kids, a couple of young kids, and I always think that it's going to be a very different world when they are under observation at all times, pretty much. And I don't know that it's a better or worse world. It's just going to be different.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, on that paranoid note.
yes, let's end it on that, by all means.
Our dystopian present or future. Thank you for calling. And again, everyone should listen to Dan Carlin talking history and common sense podcasts. And if you're not, you should. Yeah, I always recommend it.
I appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
Thanks for calling.